What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Sergeant and Mrs. Smith, you're going to love this house.
Is that a tub in the kitchen?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to Novel Dialogue, a podcast sponsored by the Society for Novel Studies and produced in partnership with Public Books, an online magazine of arts, ideas, and scholarship. I'm one of your hosts, Aarti Vade. Our longtime listeners know that Novel Dialogue got its start bringing novelists and literary critics together. This season, we both spread our wings and narrowed our focus to the theme of translation. We have discussed the nitty-gritty of word choice, the politics of writing in colonial versus indigenous languages, and how both freedom and constraint have shaped the task of the translator. And today is our capstone episode on the topic, featuring eminent translator Anne Goldstein in conversation with the wonderful scholar of Italian literature and my colleague, Saskia Zielkowski. Anne might be the most well-known translator working today, and while her star rose as the translator of the Neapolitan Quartet by Elena Ferrante, her translations of Italian literature range across the canon. She has brought us Italo Calvino, Pier Paolo Pasolini, Elsa Morante, and Primo Levi. And English language readers can also look forward to her most recent works, which bring lesser-known writers into translation, writers who might not otherwise have met American readers on American shores. Her most recent translations are A Sister's Story by Donatella di Pietrantonio and Distant Fathers by Marina Jarre. I believe Jarre's novels are only now available in English because of Anne, and this is the first, maybe not the last. So welcome, Anne. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for that very nice introduction.
Of course. And Saskia is an assistant professor, the Andrew W. Mellon Assistant Professor of Romance Studies at Duke University. And her book, Kafka's Italian Progeny, offers a fascinating look at Kafka's influence over a range of major Italian writers, including Calvino and Elena Ferrante. Saskia, you didn't tell me this, but your book was awarded the 2020 Book Prize in Literary Studies by the American Association of Italian Studies. So congratulations on that.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
It sounds like such a fantastic book, and I'm excited to read it. And I'm also thrilled to be passing the mic to you and to listen to your Italian pronunciation, because I can't do justice to these names. So
you did great. thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to have this conversation. Anne has brought so many important Italian works to English readers, and I have a number of questions as an Italianist, but I have to start with Ferrante for obvious reasons. She's the focus of so much press, popular attention, and some controversy. And Anne, you're also in a unique situation as translator, because Ferrante is a pseudonym for an author whose identity is unknown. You are her face in English. And in a profession that's often characterized by its invisibility, you're recognized as a star. With Ferrante's essays for The Guardian, your translations were also the originals. And I was just wondering, does all this affect your relationship to translating? Do you feel a different kind of responsibility or freedom? Or rather, is there anything you'd like to clarify about translating Ferrante specifically?
No, but it's an odd situation. It always it surprised me when people began to care about it. But I guess that was because they began to care about the books. But that people began to take an interest in the translator, which of course I think is a good thing for translators in general. But in terms of responsibility, I think it does give you, in a way, a greater response. I mean, I felt a greater responsibility to the author, although I don't know who the author is, and I've never been in touch with her directly. But also to the text. I mean, it seems like you have to be, I mean, I feel to some extent, of course, you always feel that you have to be faithful to the, to what you think is what you interpret as the writer's text. But in this case, it's almost more that way because there are two parts of it. I mean, there's the writing and then there's the speaking because people wanted to hear from Ferrante and there was no Ferrante to hear from. So they had to hear from me. But I try to make this very clear. You probably heard me say this. I mean, I'm not Ferrante. I don't even speak for Ferrante. I speak for her books.
You've translated not only her fiction, but also her essays and her nonfiction. So how differently do you approach translating nonfiction and fiction? Do you approach novels the same way you do other forms of writing? And do you feel like translating so much of an author, in this case Ferrante, changes how you translate, say, the novels or vice versa, having done so many of her works?
Well, first of all, I don't think that the approach is really different from nonfiction or fiction. I mean, and fiction. It's the same. I mean, I'm still, it's just me in the sentences. but certainly nonfiction is much more complicated. And nonfiction, in the case of Ferrante, and especially the essays in the margins, they gave such a greater depth of understanding of what she was, of where her books came from, in a way, of what was behind them, what's the sort of the depths of them, you know, because she really sort of explicates her, sort of her writing process, but also her thinking process over many years. And so I think in that way, of course, I haven't really translated any fiction of hers since then, since I worked on those novels. So it's hard to, I mean, on those essays, but those essays were very complicated. I mean, they were far more compressed than her novels. Every sentence was like kind of a minefield in a way, because it has so many, she's trying to do so many things in every sentence and each one is full of references. So it was really kind of a complicated operation.
There's sort of this growing movement around or debate about recognizing the translator, not only making the translator visible, but also that the translator is in fact an author of fictional works, which maybe wouldn't be said of nonfiction, that, you know, you're reading the words of the translator. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of debate about this, partially because of recognition. So, despite your crucial role in bringing Ferrante to English speakers, you're in this group of famous translators whose names are still sometimes not on the cover, for instance, on the cover of Ferrante novels. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, did you think having the translator's name on the cover changes how someone views a novel? And does it change your relationship to a work?
I don't think so. I mean, it's something that I, especially when I started, you know, I didn't think about it for myself, but I also think it wasn't such a big, you know, hadn't become an issue in any way. I mean, hadn't become a question. I mean, I do think that the translator's name should be on the cover. I think it's a publisher's, many publishers just have a policy where they don't put the translator's name on the cover and that's it. And I'm sure you know, Jennifer Croft has this, you know, whole movement, and she claims she won't translate a book unless her name is on the cover. So that cuts out some publishers for her. I mean, it's ridiculous that publishers don't rethink their policies, of course. I mean, they should. But again, I'm sort of going off to the side here a little bit. But I think, you know, it's always said that people, that when readers or when book buyers see that a book has two names on the cover, I mean, has a translator name on the cover, they turn off, you know, and they decide they're not interested. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not, if that would make a difference. On the other hand, maybe you know, now that translators' names are beginning to be known a little bit, you would say, oh, if so-and-so translated this book, maybe it's interesting.
Do you have particular translators who you feel that kind of excitement when they release a new book and you think, I must get that, the way somebody might say, my favorite author just published something, I must buy that?
Probably not.
Okay.
I mean, I know I said that, but I don't really know. I mean, I don't read that much. I don't have that much time.
That's a nice secret for us to be.
But I'm judging the National Book Awards in translation this year. Huh. So I have a way, way greater sense of, I mean, I've read a lot of books in translation in the last few months, and a lot of different translators, who some of whom I knew, you know, and had read before and stuff. But
no scoops you can share yet, right?
No. Okay. I can tell, that's as far as I can go.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit to another amazing Italian author, Primo Levi, whom you've really been also responsible for his growing presence in English. And you edited all of and translated many of the works in this really impressive 3-volume set of his complete works, which include his famous Auschwitz memoirs, but also his science fiction and other works. And I was wondering if you would maybe share a little bit about this incredible feat of translation and perhaps a specific passage.
It was astonishing to me to be able to do this, to do that. I mean, it was a very long project. Nobody likes to remember exactly how long it took, but it was an amazing project because, I mean, yes, there are his famous books and they're, you know, they're amazing, but it was really, I thought it was a great pleasure and a great service to the world to bring make his other books known. So I was just going to read a little passage from The Truce, which is one of the books that I translated, or retranslated, actually. Not all of it was retranslated. Some of it hadn't been translated. Some of the stories hadn't been translated. But most of them had. But I'll just.
Could you tell us a little about the passage before you read it?
Yes, I am good. So The Truce is the story of, The Truce is the story of Primo Levi's long and roundabout journey after he was freed from Auschwitz and how he got back to Italy. It was about 10 months, I think. It took him about 10 months. And this is the passage that I'm going to read is from the very beginning of the book, where he's still at Auschwitz and the Germans have fled and the camps are being liberated by the Red Army, the Russians. It's so complicated. If you don't know it, it seems so counterintuitive in some way, all that. But the Russians were the first people that they saw who were not Germans, that the prisoners saw who were not Germans. And this is in the early days of January in 1945. So the Germans had left the camp, and at Auschwitz, all the healthy prisoners were evacuated and they were made to march to other camps. And many of them, this is when many of the prisoners died. They hadn't died in the camp, but they died on the way during this evacuation. Primo Levi was lucky because he was in the infirmary. So he wasn't evacuated. He was basically left to die. But actually those people were better off, the people who were left, because they didn't have to walk basically barefoot in the snow for, you know, many, many miles. So this is just a very short passage. And this is when the first Russian patrol came in view of the camp. This is early January 27th of 1945. Erano quattro giovani soldati a cavallo che procedevano guardinghi coi mitragliatori imbracciati lungo la strada che limitava il campo. Quando giunsero ai reticolati, sostarono a guardare, scambiandosi parole brevi e timide e volgendo sguardi legati da uno strano imbarazzo sui cadaveri scomposti, sulle baracche sconquassate e su noi pochi vivi. 4 young soldiers on horseback, machine guns under their arms, proceeded warily along the road that followed the perimeter of the camp. When they reached the fences, they paused to look, and with a brief, timid exchange of words, turned their gazes, checked by a strange embarrassment, to the jumbled corpses, to the ruined barracks, and to us few living beings. So I was just going to talk about this one word, actually, scomposti. Which is really, in a way, was one of the hardest words in this whole this whole little passage. Actually, there were two hard words. The other hard word was this word imbracciati, which Italians disagreed about whether it meant under their arms or slung over their shoulders. So it was kind of an interesting, this is just to give you a little bit of the range of issues that come up. So it was kind of fascinating. Anyway, but scomposti is a different idea. It's also complicated because it has many different meanings. Again, in translation, words with many meanings are often the hardest, or sometimes they're the easiest because you can just grab whatever meaning you need, but you don't always know what that meaning is. So in this case, the scomposti is the past participle of the verb scomporre, which means to take apart, but also to throw into disorder, to disarrange, to make a mess of. And it also has a kind of undertone of unseemly or obscene. So the problem is to decide, like, which of those meanings was stronger in this case of bodies piled up, or of corpses piled up, even, you could say. So the translator has to choose. It involves elimination, essentially. Like, this isn't, you try this, you try that, and another important point that I would make is that you have to try it. You think of all the meanings of a word, or you look at a million different thesauruses, you look at dictionaries, and then you think, oh, okay, this word is, this seems like just the right meaning. And then you read it in the sentence and it's not right at all. And then it also has to work in the paragraph. So it has to work in all these different ways. Anyway, the dictionaries in this case offered, you know, a bunch of possibilities. The cognate would have been discomposed, but that's really not right. I mean, that's usually more of a person who's out of order. And my first idea actually was purely physical, although in a slightly different sense, because I thought of them as corpses, and that they were, first I thought, oh, well, maybe they were decomposing. But then I realized, well, no, it's winter. It's freeze. They've been talking about how freezing it is. They aren't decomposing. So that was too literal. And when I thought about the different meanings, and I thought about the actual scene, I did think of it as a jumbled pile of bodies, of corpses all jumbled together, because we know that there's a common grave, and the grave is overflowing with bodies. So I also consulted at this point with an Italian Levy scholar who he was actually the person who brought up the idea of, I mean, he's who noted the underlying idea of what's something unseemly, something obscene, which is this pile of bodies that are unburied. So he suggested, he was talking about like a pile of bones and limbs thrown together. And then a few lines earlier, we've read about this common grave. And so it seemed like it could be something like unseemly. Because he says, I'm sorry, I'm just going to read this, that they dumped him not into the grave, but on the dirty snow, because the grave was full and no other burial could be given. That's Levy writing. And the fact that no burial could be given is already indecent, is already obscene. So it didn't need that extra connotation of obscenity. And so I went back to the idea of the jumble of bodies. I thought that to say something obscene or unseemly would carry too much moral judgment, because the soldiers have already given their moral judgment by the way they're looking. So in the end, it was just, it was the jumbled bodies, I think. What did I say? The jumbled corpses. And I also used the word corpses as a less impersonal word than bodies. So that's one word. I mean, that's an extreme case maybe, but still, you couldn't do that with every word. But that's really the process is like that, especially when you have a word that seems important.
Part of what I find so strong about this passage in both the Italian and the English is sort of the visual external ending with the us, the noi at the end. And I feel like the translation did such a amazing job of sort of getting that, this, you know, the gaze from the outside and how visual it is before it gets to that these are, you know, people that are on the inside. And there's, they're, it does seem like it could be a little hard to get that contrast with, since you're dealing with the people at the end, but this very visual experience at the beginning.
Yeah, well, actually the ending, there was a little, I mean, a question about one of the, I mean, I ended up, it's in Italian, it's just pochi vivi, just a few living. And in English, just didn't seem to work as the few living. So I added beings because it seemed that it needed another, it needed a real noun. I mean, because in English, the doesn't work so quite as neatly to have a, to use an adjective as a noun as it does in Italian.
Since this was one of the retranslated works, I was wondering about the differences between the canonical authors, like the Truce and the Periodic Table and Morante's Arturo's Island and Calvino's The Baron in the Trees, versus the contemporary authors, Marella Cus and Nadia Terranova, Donatella di Pietrantonio, Giampalihiri, and of course Ferrante, that you're translating for the first time. As when you had different the decisions to retranslate, both in terms of taking on the project, but then also if it changes the process at all for you.
Well, it's kind of nerve-wracking because, first of all, for two reasons. One is because they're great writers, and that it's already nerve-wracking to translate a, you know, someone who is known to be, who is a great writer. but it's also a little nerve-wracking to retranslate something because, you know, you don't, you just feel like, are you, there's a, it's not, I wouldn't call it competitive, but it's just like, you know, maybe the, their solutions were better or maybe they came, maybe they, the other, or he, in most cases, I think it was a he of all these books. As a matter of fact, I don't know. I mean, I just always think the other person could did it better. That's my problem. On the other hand, it's also true that, and I've never been able to answer this question, that translations do date. I mean, translations date in a way that original works don't. And there's reasons to retranslate books. You know, the old ones, the old translations just don't read that well. I mean, the Levy was interesting because in If This Is a Man, Stuart Wolfe, actually, I think he's still alive. He was the original translator. He had always wanted to revise his translation. And so this gave him a chance to do that. I mean, I worked with him a lot on it, but he, you know, that was really great. And I wonder how many other translators would want that opportunity. But also the translation was dated. So, and he understood that, you know, and he was happy to go along with suggestions and to make his own corrections.
Yeah, with the Morante, it was exciting for me that I feel like you were able to bring more of Morante's weirdness into English, and that maybe the mm-hmm. first time when people are translating, sometimes there's like a hesitancy to she has a lot of weird things in her language.
Yeah.
And I felt like Arturo's Island, when you translated it, really showed that in a way that is wonderful. Mm-hmm. That maybe was you would one would withhold potentially to make it more accessible the first time.
Right.
So that's also an exciting I'm very excited you retranslated her as well.
Oh, thank you. But also it's also true that sometimes I think in a different era of translation there were different practices, different standards. For example, speaking of Morante, the original, there is a translation of Menzogne Sortilegio, which was just, you know, sort of freely cut and pasted by the translator. So it's, and which is coming out, I think, in the spring within a new translation by Jenny McPhee from New York Review Books.
And I imagine she's doing all of it, not, you know, her favorite 200 pages. That's great.
And she's doing all of it. Yeah. So exactly. I mean, there's definitely a feeling that you wouldn't you wouldn't like play fast and loose quite as much as I think you might have in the past, which is kind of what you were talking about in terms of, you know, making something accessible.
Have you followed the discussion around female translators of classical texts? I think maybe Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey.
Oh, right.
Right.
I haven't really followed it. I mean, I know what you mean, what you're talking about.
Yeah. In general, what a female translator brings to the classical tradition and whether, you know, translations date, as you mentioned, but whether certain characters come alive in a different way, like Penelope might figure differently in a female translator.
I mean, yeah, I would think so.
Yeah,
you know, and I do. I actually had this. I went to. I was in Florence yesterday with my friend Jenny, and we went to the to San Marco, and we were looking at the Fra Angelico stuff. But this woman, this guard there, told us about that there were three lunettes by a woman painter of that time, a nun. And when I looked her up, I found that she had painted A Last Supper, and that the details apparently are very different from the normal Last Supper. So I haven't seen this painting, so I don't know any of what the details were, but things like the food was different, and the whatever they were using to eat, the cutlery was different or something. Anyway, but that's really just to your point. I mean,
can I ask if you've ever had that experience with a retranslation project where you felt something that you retranslated or came out very differently in a certain region of the text than the original translation?
The fact is I usually don't read the original.
Oh, the original translations.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I had read, let's say, the periodic table. Of course, I had read it many years ago, but I didn't remember it, and I didn't look. I prefer just to do it as if it were the first translation.
Understood. Yeah.
Because you know, there's many ways you know you don't want to have the other translator's voice in your mind, and then you could sometimes you think, well, there's only one way to say it, but many things there's like, you know, 10 ways to say it. They're all correct.
You don't want to foreclose your options with another translator's choice. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Or feel like maybe you have to do something different too, I imagine, if you read
that too. Exactly. Yeah.
But Saskia, you've taught multiple translations before, even side by side, right? And so you've told me that you try to eliminate a kind of evaluation model when one is assessing translations side by side.
When my students interpret, I often encourage using multiple translations since they're all lead to different paths of interpretation. And I don't want them to say like, this is better or that is better, but to sort of think about the way they're reading and how they can engage the translations to show how their reading makes sense. Not say like, oh, the translator should use this word.
Poetry, it's sort of famously said, I guess, that you know, well, I myself would never translate poetry, but that if you read maybe five or six translations of a poem, then maybe you get something of the idea of it.
It is, yeah, it's so helpful to read, for everyone to read translations too, in terms of understanding the meaning. I wanted to sort of go back to Artie's question about a little bit about the identity of the translator changing how one potentially either translates or understands the text. On the more recent debate, so not Homer, but with, say, Amanda Gorman, where there's been a lot of debate about identity of the author and translator and how close they maybe should be or shouldn't be. And many of your translated works feature women with intense relationships, and then a sizable number also are by authors with Jewish heritage. And I was wondering if the relationship between your identities and those of your authors influence how or why you translate.
Well, why I translate is usually because somebody proposes a book for me, to me. And I do decide, you know, I do say no. But I think especially with a first person woman narrator, it's impossible for me not to identify in some way. I mean, certainly with the Neapolitan novels. And also because there's no author, I mean, even for me, there's no, I mean, the author to me is the voice of the writer, of the text in a way. So I do kind of, I mean, however different I am from the actual person, I'm still somehow that voice in fiction, particularly. I mean, it's less true in nonfiction.
It's sort of easier to inhabit the imaginary space. Not that you're saying you are that person, but that it's easier.
No, but yeah. But I definitely, yeah, that's a better way of putting it. Thank you.
And that's what the concept of fictionality has historically enabled, right? That license or that leap that one is more, I think, careful about taking when there feels like a biographical person that one is reading, right? So when the nonfiction seems to align more with a body in the world,
right.
Whereas the fiction,
yeah.
The character is,
yeah.
Some, as one person scholar said it, nobody's story. There's no physical body in the world that the character can be pinned to.
Right.
And that does allow you a kind of freedom.
Yeah, no, that's true.
You mentioned being asked to translate things, which was how Primo Levi ended up translating Kafka, which I think also had to do with their identities, why they were asked. And Primo Levi really felt tortured by the experience. And I was wondering if there are any authors that you regret translating or that tortured you in some way, that you took on a project and then later thought, I don't, you know, that maybe it wasn't as good a fit as the person asking thought it was.
Well, there's two ways to answer that. First of all, I don't think there are authors who I've been tortured by and who I did kind of regret. I mean, on some level regret, but I'm not going to say who they are.
Well, and Kafka is wonderful. So it's not an insult to the author. It's sort of the experience of translating. Right.
And then the other way to answer that is to say, I never regret anything because I always learn something from whoever I translate. And even if it is torturous, I mean, in the way of that I was talking about, which is that, you know, that the prose just isn't good or it just turns out to be too hard or just not that good. But, and Primo Levi, you could also say was kind of torturous because of the subject. I mean, because of his problems with Kafka. I had some problems like that with him. I mean, not problems, but, you know, moments where you have to walk away. The new Marina Jar has moments like that. I don't know if you've read it in Italian. Well, I guess it hasn't come out in Italian yet.
I did. An older copy exists.
But you have the
Italian. And the Lettonia, what will it be, and it's coming out in February?
I think something like that, yeah.
And it's were you happy at the end? I can imagine it. I mean, I found her first one also, there's a lot of hard topics in there. And as a reader, it can be hard, but I would imagine the translator even more with Primo Levi and Marina Jar.
Because you're so in the middle of it and you're so involved in it. Whether you're the writer or the translator. I mean, Calvino has this essay about, you know, translation is the closest way to read. And it's true. And so you can get overwhelmed when the subject is difficult. I mean, is painful, I guess one should say, like in those two cases, in the Primo Levi, especially in Survival in Auschwitz and in the Return to Latvia.
And do you, are there, or have those works, or are there other works that you feel like have changed your relationship to language or translating, or sort of at all, are there any Italian works that have transformed what you think of, how you think in English or think about English?
I mean, in a way you could say, yeah, everything changes the way I think about language. I mean, every translation, the way every translation teaches you something about the language. I mean, it teaches you, I mean, you could say it teaches you about English too, because every time you have to find a way in English of conveying a different author, a different style in a different Italian style into English. So it, in a way you could say that that's, you're transforming your English every time. I mean, because it does, I think that by being faithful to the text, which of course I don't mean literal, to the text, I think that that's really the way of emphasizing the style of bringing out the writing, the style. And I think that that if you, I mean, I'm going to say something very bold. if you read a bunch of my translations, I don't think they all sound the same. They don't. I mean, whether, you know, some people say, oh, you can recognize a translation by so-and-so or by so-and-so. I don't know if that's true or not, but to me, it seems like the different authors have different styles and that's clear.
Primo Levi and Ferrante are certainly feel extremely different to me in terms of voice.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the translator has to be a ventriloquist or a medium in the way that you inhabit sometimes the pain of the translation that you're doing? Or do you try to avoid these kinds of other metaphors, translator as something else to explain the process?
No, I mean, I do, I think you are inhabiting it. I mean, one of my favorite ones is The Actor. Is this, I don't know if you know this essay by Cesare Garboli about the translators as actors. And I think the performer idea is really kind of a good one. At least it works for me. As that you're, this is one version of something, you know, of a, I mean, how do you separate the pianist and the,
right,
and the work? They sort of become each other for that moment or those moments of the performance. So I think that's one of the things I like. There's an Italian translator, a woman who translates from English into Italian, Martina Testa. She says she thinks of herself as a mechanic. I don't think she really believes that, but okay. That's her metaphor.
Craft.
Yeah.
Actor, mechanic, author. It's so interesting, the different ways that it can be characterized.
Yeah. And then there's the puzzle solver.
Oh, right. Especially for Calvino, maybe.
Yeah.
So there's so little that's translated to English, you know, it's often estimated to be less than 3%. And the small percentage of that that is translated from Italian to English has really grown, thanks in large part to you and other wonderful.
Is that true?
It has, yeah. They've done studies, or at least there's been a couple things that have come out that says there's now more that's being translated from Italian. And I certainly feel like my people I meet are more likely to know Italian authors than was true for a while. And you're really shaping what English readers consume from Italy. And I was wondering how you decide to translate the less obvious authors and work. Like, I'll name two that I've been recommending to a lot of people. So Bucci's Always Remember Your Name, or Jarre's Distant Fathers, which are wonderful, but wouldn't necessarily, you know, they didn't have to be translated necessarily.
Well, the Bucci has sort of a long story. And which is that a woman I didn't know, whose son-in-law, if you want to hear this whole story, because sometimes this happens, whose son-in-law was the Italian consul in San Francisco. I mean, Italian. He presented Andra Bucci, one of the sisters who wrote that book, with a prize or some kind of award or prize or something. And this woman, the mother-in-law, who had spent time in Italy and knows Italian, but she read the book in Italian. It was like the first book she'd ever actually read in Italian. And she just thought, this has to be published. And she wrote to me out of the blue and said, would I consider translating it or trying to get it published? And I read it and I thought it should be published. I thought it was a really, it's a very moving book, and it's a story that isn't that common. Their whole story was so interesting. And the fact that they didn't write it until they were in their 80s or 70s, I mean, was just, I mean, I thought that in a way, you know, the part of the book that was almost more interesting is how they came around to being able to do it.
Thank you so much for all these wonderful answers. And I now have the a signature question for the season of the podcast, which is there a word or concept that you consider untranslatable or very difficult to translate? And what is it?
Yes, every word, every concept. But I mean, I actually, this, I'm not joking, but it sounds like a joke. The word that I recently had a lot of trouble with was, it's just a very common word in Italian, portiere. It's like a doorman, but you can't say doorman in an Italian context. It's just not right. But it's sort of a person with some doorman functions and some other functions. And sometimes this is in Forbidden Notebook, there are two ways that portiere is used. One as a sort of doorman person and the other is a sort of office receptionist, but it's not really like a receptionist. So how do you translate these words? I mean, do you say doorman? Do you say concierge? Do you say porter? I mean, it's these kinds of small physical almost, or, you know, jobs and physical things, objects that don't exist in the other culture, that in a way are the hardest to translate. I mean, I don't know if they're the hardest, but it's difficult to find an equivalent, because there isn't an equivalent. I mean, there isn't one that's an exact match. But the other, I mean, I won't go into this too much, but the other thing that I think is untranslatable, of course, especially in Italian, is dialect. People talk about dialect all the time. People, Italian writers use it, not exclusively, but Ferrante actually less than others. Pasolini famously has this kind of made up Roman slang. I mean, part real and part his own. So those are things that I think are really hard to convey. I mean, that someone is, I mean, you know, Ferrante solved the problem in a way for her translators by saying somebody, so-and-so said this in dialect. So then you don't have to worry. And then she writes in Italian, but other writers don't necessarily do that.
Yeah. Do you tend to, I think of Argon too, do you tend to keep the word then when it's in dialect, or go with, I mean, what are some of the ways that you approach that? Because I agree that's such a difficult...
Sometimes I leave the word in dialect. It was just a word. Maybe that wasn't really a dialect, sort of a dialect word. In The Lying Life of Adults, there were some words. And I think sometimes I left them, and sometimes I just tried to find a word that was, you know, basically slangy, but not too slangy, because slang is so particular. It ends up sounding false in some way. So you can't really. I mean, in the past, it ages much faster than everything else. I mean, I can't speak to a young person now.
Could you tell us the choice you used for doorman versus porter versus?
I think that what we so far, this book has not come out yet, so it could change. We ended up saying using porter for the person who was at the apartment building, the person who would open the door, let's say, or hand you your mail. It's not precise, but it seemed better than, I mean, concierge just, it seems too French or too fancy or something.
Right.
This is like a poor building.
You know, I don't know if this is helpful to know or not, but there's a beautiful short story by Salman Rushdie from East West. It's called The Quarter, and it's a play on the role a porter plays for this building in a multicultural London neighborhood, not a particularly wealthy building.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's just the porter, but he does things that go beyond the call of duty, and he's romantic. And so the title is The Quarter.
Yeah.
I really appreciated having this conversation with you both. And I feel like I've learned so much about translation from the inside. So Anne and Saskia, thank you again for making time for Novel Dialogue. As we approach the end of the show, we'd like to thank the Society for Novel Studies for its sponsorship, Public Books for its partnership, and acknowledge support from Duke University. Hannah Jorgensen is our production intern and designer, and Connor Hibbard is our sound engineer. Our backlist includes episodes with George Saunders, Viet Thanh Nguyen, Ruth Ozeki, Damon Galgut, and more. So from all of us here at Novel Dialogue, thank you for listening. And if you liked what you heard, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.